In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Was violence endemic in the British Empire, or was it the result of a few bad apples straying from the civilising mission? In her new book, Legacy of Violence, Professor Caroline Elkins of Harvard University argues that it was very much the former. She explains how liberal imperialism was able to coexist with regular acts of brutality across Britain's colonial domains. Caroline explores these ideas in conversation with Rob Attar.
Caroline, in your book, you view the British Empire through the lens of violence. And is it fair to say that you see violence as being absolutely integral to British imperialism?
Yes, I do, Rob. And I think when I think about violence in the British Empire, what I'm interested in is not just demonstrating the ways in which it's endemic. It's not a series of one-offs explaining violent episodes by perhaps a bad apple or perhaps an extreme situation in a particular colony, but rather showing how it's a thread that runs through the narrative. This book covers almost 200 years. And running through the narrative such that violence is always part of the equation, and I should add, so too is reform. And I think one of the conundrums that we find with the British Empire, and many empires, but we're talking particularly about the British here, and that is that coercion and reform end up being two sides of the same coin, this notion of the civilizing mission. And I think it's in that sense that Legacy of Violence is really looking to help the reader understand how this happens, why it happens, and how we can make sense in some ways of the present based upon some of these patterns that we see in the past.
And actually, I was going to ask you about that idea of the civilizing mission. I mean, how did British imperialists square that with all the violence that was being conducted as part of this project?
Yeah, that's a really fantastic question because, you know, at the time in the 19th century, when towering figures, John Stuart Mill and others, were debating and we had violent episodes, right? We had 1857 in India. We had the Morant Bay Rebellion in Jamaica. And this notion, this developmentalist notion about taking liberalism to brown and black subjects, colonial subjects around the empire, was already vexing, right? This idea that it was going to take centuries. At some point, they would be like us, right? In this kind of civilizing mission, this white man's burden. But what was interesting is in the aftermath, particularly of Jamaica in the Morant Bay Rebellion, figures like John Stuart Mill couldn't contain this dualism, that reform and coercion were two sides of the same coin. And one of the things that I demonstrate in the book that I found as an historian quite interesting is that humanists could. So people like Robert Louis Stevenson, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, one can be both at the same time. And this idea of liberal imperialism, which is in and of itself an oxymoron, was very, very difficult for those in the 19th century and even going forward to contain in a single frame. And that's something that, and it takes me about 800 pages to do it, that I'm really trying to help the reader see through example by showing and not telling how this plays out and how one can be, how things can be both at once. And it's a difficult concept even for a writer to get one's mind around. And so I think one of my goals as the writer is to help the reader through this and to see how this plays out over the course of time.
Now, in your first answer, you mentioned or alluded to this argument that was sometimes put forward that there was a few bad apples. These events were not central to the empire. There were rogue actors taking actions beyond their brief. Do you think that the British imperialists and the British authorities genuinely believed that argument, or were they themselves aware that that wasn't true?
You know, that's the $64,000 question, right? In American lingo, what do people believe at the time, right? And again, it's something that I spent a lot of time sort of peeling off kind of layer after layer for the reader to have a sense that by and large, those at the top, those making decisions, those sitting in Whitehall, those in Downing Street, they knew that these were not one-offs or bad apples. And in fact, there was this constant working and reworking of how does one conceive of this developmentalism, this liberal imperialism, this civilizing mission in a way that shields the public from the coercive nature of it, or downplays that aspect of it, or justifies that aspect of it, while holding up the element of reform. And I think that's a crucial point. And in some ways, it's up to the reader to decide who knew what. What did knowing mean? I provide lots of information. And one of the goals of the book is to invite a wider conversation about how and why this is happening. And your question really sort of really pinpoints one of the key questions around this.
So you said that there's perhaps some disagreement about whether these people knew the extent of the violence. Were there times where the violence was actually being centrally directed? Were there instructions from London, or was this generally happening on the ground?
Unquestionably, it was coming from London, directly. And certainly, so that's the headline, right, to your question. And it was coming directly from London, not just from the political right, when the Tories were in power, Churchill and others who readers might associate with sort of being the standard bearers of empire, but also from labor. When we think about the post-war Attlee labor regime, they're right in the thick of it in Malaya in particular, right? Ernest Bevin, the foreign secretary. There's an overall understanding and policy and acceptance of the use of violence at a state level, right? And this book is very much about state-directed violence. At the same time, each colony sort of floated its own boat, right? They developed some of their own local policies. They developed some of their own, certainly local techniques. However, what the book also demonstrates is that while each colony may have had its own separate local administration, some of these historical actors who were carrying out the orders, who were carrying out the policies, who were moving between one colony to the next. So in some ways, as I describe in the book, it's like a spider's web, right? All these different connections. And only by stepping back and taking in its totality can the reader truly understand the ways in which not just orders were coming from the top, not just the ways in which there were directions coming from individual colonies, but how these were all connected between each other. And I think that's one of the things I'm hoping readers will take away from this book.
And when you're talking about imperial violence, what kind of forms did this take? Is it mainly military campaigns? Are we talking about harsh punishments for criminality and things like that? Or is it something different?
You know, it's a whole range of things. You know, we have, very high level, massive policies of forced relocations. Some of the largest forced relocation policies in history, with the exception of the trade in enslaved peoples, first happens in Malaya and then happens in Kenya. The construction of what are called emergency villages, the forced relocation in barbed wire villages of Chinese in Malaya and then Kikuyu in Kenya and elsewhere. These were, of course, drawing on policies that had been long in existence in the British Empire and readers and listeners may be familiar with what was taking place in the South African or the Boer War, which really set precedent, then was carried on to India. So these don't just come out of nowhere, right? They're all connected historically. And then we have policies, if we go from the very big picture, right? How do you take massive amounts of populations and sort of relocate them, contain them? And then the question becomes, how do you punish them, right? And that punishment is often framed within a liberalizing notion of reform. In Kenya, it was called rehabilitation, right? Earlier on, it was called the moral effect of violence. What is it about coercion that can take, if you will, sort of childlike creatures, and I use sort of the scare quotes and around that as they were often described at the time, how do you take those childlike creatures and force their development, right? Force them beyond this kind of supposed criminality. And you do that through all sorts of, you know, whether it's forced labor policy, whether it's legal punishment of 12 strokes with a cane, and of course, all of this, the legality of it is central to the book because the British government renders legal many actions that had previously been illegal, right? That would have invited prosecution. Then, of course, the book does not shy away from the nature of how punishments play out on the ground. If you center state-directed violence as a main focus of a book, then statistics are not enough. Describing the lived experiences, what it felt like to be tortured, what it looked like, how it felt and what those were thinking who perpetrated some of these acts. And so in that sense, readers should be prepared and at the same time, in many ways, to understand the ways in which the empire impacted not just those who were considered the colonized, but also those in the military, those in the colonial service. There are certainly some who bragged about this, others who were deeply, deeply affected by it. And it really changed the course of their lives. And I think the readers, and I can certainly say for my own self, felt deeply empathic to many of the historical actors that I excavate and present their lived experiences within the book.
Did the extent of the violence depend, was it racialized? Did it depend on the kinds of people that were being encountered by the British imperialists? I mean, for example, were the white dominions treated differently in this regard to places in India and Africa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think let's sort of step back and think about how did race play out in sort of the civilizing mission? What happened in the 19th century when liberalism, right, this notion that the spread of the rule of law, the participation in free market economy, all these things that were being extended in greater and greater ways in Britain itself in the 19th century with the Reform Acts, right? What happens when those notions are taken to distant shores, right? And when brown and black populations don't look like us, and suddenly skin color becomes, if you will, one of the markers of difference. And certainly one that brands, if you will, the ways in which coercion can be deployed to develop, to lift up, to execute the white man's burden. Now, I want to make an important point on this, and the book's quite clear on it, which is, you asked the question, it was an important one, how you framed it, racialized, right? So race can be skin color, as we all know. But racializing the Irish or the Afrikaners, let's use those two examples, who are white populations. However, they were not British. They were not seen as being civilized in the same way that Britons were. And so therefore, the same kinds of policies that we see being executed in India and Kenya and Malaya are similarly being executed in Ireland and South Africa. And I would also point out, as the book does, those two locations, South Africa and Ireland, are absolutely instrumental to our story. So what it tells you are the ways in which liberalism, again, it can rework and work itself such that explaining how it is that you can torture Irish, you can detain women and children in South Africa, have them die at alarming rates, and justify this through the language of reform and the civilizing mission.
How effective, by its own terms, was this violence? Did it serve to keep the colonized populations under control, or did it just beget more violence?
It's, again, another very good question. It's the book really traces this and the degree to which we see reprisals and counter-reprisals, like a spiral playing out. Violence begets more violence. And at the end of the day, we can look in a very different kind of way. I want to be careful about not making too close of an analogy. But if listeners are thinking about the ways in which Ukrainians today are digging in and protecting their home front, what they're willing to do that, imagine, if you will, 50, 60, 70 years ago. You have an empire, a colonizer that has come in, that is deploying massive violence, and you are seeking your freedom, your independence from this rule, your ability to live and operate in ways that are no longer under the British thumb. And of course, these things play out in interesting and very complicated ways, because to be thinking about just sort of the colonizer and the colonized, right? Counter-reprisals, reprisals. The lines of divide become very blurry at different points. And that's something else I invite the reader to experience with me as the writer, right? To be seeing the ways in which local populations will switch sides and allegiances just to survive. Things become so bad, right? Different points at which those who are, if we take, for an example, any of them, the IRA, the Mau Mau movement, the Chinese in Malaya, could be as draconian and violent against their own populations when they suspected or thought that somebody was being disloyal and fighting on the British side, if you will. And so in that sense, these become incredibly violent, sometimes confusing, wars that have no end. And I think that's the other thing. I mean, obviously, eventually they do end. But this notion that these will be, which happens over and again, these are three-month war. It'll be over very quickly. Just does not play out.
Now, and as you've mentioned, this violence received a lot of opposition from the colonized people. But were there also people within Britain who were opposed and trying to prevent this violence taking place?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think the idea that everybody just fell in line back in Britain, right, would be erroneous, for sure. And I think as an historian, there are several things. One, you see the backlash that many of those who protested, who went out to empire to find evidence, right? Who, you know, we can go back to Amritsar and Montague, who at the time, who was the Indian secretary, and the heaps of abuse that he withstood. And of course, ends up dying at quite a young age. We go later on, if we fast forward to Barbara Castle in Kenya and Malaya. But then we have many others. Those who are anti-war, who are pacifists. We can kind of go on and on in terms of collections of individuals. And I think in that sense, it's both an indication that, this idea that there was something, sort of British about executing this kind of violence is a very sweeping statement to make, considering the number of individuals who were outspoken at the time. And to be frank, given the level of cover-ups that were happening, it's quite extraordinary the work that they did. And today, as an historian, some of the work that they did is absolutely crucial. You'll find it in the footnotes of this book. Absolutely crucial to piecing the story back together again, and also absolutely crucial for Britons in the present day, to be thinking and considering about how and why it was that they were protesting. What was it that had them so upset? And I think in that sense, also, the book definitely takes us not just in the empire, but it moves us back and forth, right? Where at one moment the reader is going to be in Kenya, and then suddenly they're going to be back in London to see how this is playing out, why it's playing out in certain ways, then taking us back out to empire, say, for example, in Malaya or somewhere else.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And so I think it's important to remember that all empires are violent. The threat of violence is always there. Does it happen every day in every place in every second? No. And the question becomes, what I'm quite interested in is looking at when violence erupts. Right? And when violence erupts and when it's state-directed violence.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You said there was nothing particularly British about this kind of imperial violence. So does that mean that the other European empires behaved similarly, or were there things that were worse about the British Empire?
Let me step back and answer your question sort of full stop insofar as all empires are violent, right? Full stop. The question becomes, what's the nature of that violence and why is it playing out the way that it is? What I'm making an argument in this book about is that there is something, you know, the notion of liberal imperialism, which is a very much of a 19th century idea. And what I say is that, and I make the argument that this notion of liberal imperialism, which is a sort of a broad umbrella for the civilizing mission, right, where it can contain those on the far right and the far left, and it can contain, it can even contain some of those protesting against the violence. It's not as though many of them disagreed with the principle of the civilizing mission, which is it was Britain's burden to uplift those less fortunate, those less developed, if you will, throughout the empire. But just believing that coercion shouldn't be used, right? But remember, what makes the British Empire different, perhaps, than, say, and I'm very clear in this, for those at the time, parts of the empire may have looked and felt like sort of Nazi Germany. But they're different. This is not a totalitarian state in the same way because, there's no end date to the Nazi Empire, right? It's supposed to go on in perpetuity. At some point, the British Empire is to be declared a success. At some point, it could be a generation away or two centuries away, but at some point, the notion was that the colonized populations would develop, that the civilizing mission would take hold, right? And that's what makes it different. The French are not dissimilar in some ways insofar as, but of course the French think about sort of creating 100 million Frenchmen around the world. The British are not up to that. And, I do raise this question in the book itself, which is, you know, at the end of the day, this developmentalism, that's sort of the crux of what I would invite readers to think about. This developmentalism and, you know, at what point does that yet come, right? Often we'll hear they're coming along, but just not yet. Now, one of the arguments that I make in the book is that not yet never comes. Even when independence comes along, and we think about whether or not Brown and Black and others from the former empire could ever be British. And I think that's a question one has to ask oneself when one is thinking about the ways in which empire is playing out in the present day. And that's fundamentally different than the French, right? There's an idea that they are creating 100 million Frenchmen around the world. And so we see some tension there. And, you know, once again, Rob, I do, there are no easy answers to this. Rather, my goal is to present a range of evidence that is informed and ask readers to think about this. I can certainly say, and the book very much builds on an extraordinary range of historical scholarship that has evolved over, say, the last 10 or 15 years in particular, that it's very difficult any longer to say, oh, this is a one-off here or one-off there, right? And that's one of the things that I'm seeking to demonstrate with the book. And if we accept this as being more or less historical fact, then the question that we should be, or the questions that we should be asking ourselves is how and why is this happening? Right? What's the legacy? How do we understand those protesting in the 1950s? And how do we think about the ways in which liberal imperialism in different ways still continue to play out today?
And actually, thinking about the present day, it's interesting that certainly here in Britain, there are still a large number of people, possibly even a majority of the population, who view the British Empire far more favourably and certainly, I suppose, might take issue with some of the arguments in your book. Why do you think that this sort of slightly rosier view of the British Empire still persists in Britain?
I think it's we have to step back and ask ourselves the question, the ways in which history had been written for many, many, many decades, right? And I just gestured to, and I really underscore the shift, at least in the historical profession, and certainly in those doing it, if you will, as kind of crossover books, right, who write for academia as well as for the public. Some incredible work on case studies of violence in the empire. And one of the things that Legacy of Violence is doing is sort of getting its arms around all of this and putting it into a coherent narrative. And at the same time, historical revisionism is in a bit of an uphill battle, right? I mean, if you have decades, centuries of the entwining of nation, empire, and the monarchy, and this was done quite deliberately by Disraeli in the 19th century of, if you will, fashioning at the time of Queen Victoria, a British national identity that entwined those three elements. And even to this day, right, the Queen is head of various parts of the Commonwealth. You know, I could go on, and listeners are certainly aware of that. And, you know, so I think in that sense, yes, there will be those who may read this and say, you know, this is hyperbolizing. This is, you know, I've done my best. There's about 100 pages of footnotes, 50 pages of bibliography. But I would also ask listeners and readers to bear something else in mind, which is there are deliberate efforts at the very highest levels, not just within the British government, but within the Oxbridge Academy for a very long period of time to cover this up and to write laudatory narratives about empire. The book demonstrates that, how that was happening during the Second World War, and certainly demonstrates, as have others, the ways in which documents were concealed and burned on massive scales. And so I think in that sense, you know, there's a lot of debate right now about the impact of removing statues, you know, how that erases history. And, you know, look, that's happened for a very long period of time, the removal of statues, when we have turns of events, new episodes, new ways of thinking about the present. Burning documents, concealing documents, now that distorts history. And the question in the book raises this, and that is, how much has the British public known? And so I encourage in that sense, whether it's my book or others that are out there, to really spend time thinking about the ways in which the historical record has been manipulated and the ways in which historians, I think, are doing some incredibly important work in sort of, you know, piecing fragments back together again so that the public understands how we in the present arrived here and the ways in which the past is informing that.
Have any of these concealed documents since come to light and helped inform your work and that of others?
Yes, it, you know, it's interesting. My first book was on Kenya and detention camps, something in Britain called Britain's Gulag. In the U.S., it's known as, the same book, known as Imperial Reckoning. So that book came out in about 2005, 2006. And then in 2009 became the basis for the first time the British government has ever been sued by a former colonized population. And I joined as expert witness and then was joined subsequently a year or two later by two other fantastic Kenyan historians. And the case lasted between 2009 and 2013, so about 4 years. And the British government fought the case not on, if you will, the historical merits, but rather on two legal technicalities. So there are two strikeout hearings, one about whether or not it was the right venue in Britain, whether or not this case should be in Kenya, and the second one was on statute of limitations. And the reason I'm providing these details to you and the listeners is because just before the first strikeout hearing, the British government made an enormous sort of discovery, and I kind of use those in quotes as well, coming to the court and explaining that after, you know, well over a year plus of demands from the claimant's attorneys for document discovery, which comes with any court case, they had discovered 300 boxes of previously undisclosed files at Hanslope Park, which is where all the MI5 and MI6 files are contained. It's also known, you know, sort of locally as Spook Central. And then, oh, by the way, next to those 300 boxes were 8,000 other files from 36 other colonies that on all of these files had been packed up from the different colonies, spirited away, and then concealed for decades until this court case came along. And so the relevance of these files was twofold. The most immediate, which was the case at hand, that is the Mau Mau case in the High Court of London. And those documents become very important because they provide us with more, if you will, written evidentiary evidence of wrongdoing, torture, systematic violence, and the like in Kenya. And ultimately, that case did settle in 2013. There was a £20 million sterling payout to the victims and an official apology given by Foreign Secretary Haig on the floor of Parliament. But the value and significance of those files obviously extended well beyond the case itself. And so not just for the Kenyan files, but for those that were discovered for the 36 other colonies become important to my own work. And what I found interesting and something that I discuss in the book, and that is we had the power of the court behind us in the Kenyan files that were discovered, right? These 300 boxes. And what happened was as expert witness, I had access to the files because they were scanned and uploaded into a searchable database. But the British government, defended by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, could cull these files based on two aspects. One, sensitivity, if any were, you know, potentially exposed, if you will, state secrets. And the other was relevance. And so ensued sort of this back and forth between myself and the team of students I had helping me with this, the claimant's attorneys, and the FCO, because you know, they didn't want to release all the files, right? Long story short. So as sometimes the analogy used, it's like getting, you know, page 157 of a book and then getting page 5, and then getting page 6. We're getting all these in piecemeal ways. And there were many, many requests, not just from myself, but from the two other historians, of compelling the Foreign and Commonwealth Office to release more of the documents. But those requests went away when the settlement was reached. So that's one. Two, that which is in the now in the Public Record Office, or now known as the National Archives out at Kew, from the 36 other colonies, these did not have the power of the court behind them. And so that which remains there largely are sort of about banal sort of day-to-day administrative things. And one has to suspend a little bit of disbelief in thinking that they've been hidden all these years in Spook Central and there was really nothing in them. You know, there's a few interesting bits and not to say they're irrelevant by any stretch. There's some important things in there, and there's some important things that one can sort of use to integrate into other evidence. But I guess what I'm saying, it's a very long answer to your short question, but what I'm saying is that a few things. One, yes, those many of these, but I suspect not all, of the concealed documents have been released. Those that were released, there are differences between those that were released that had the power of the court behind them and those that did not. And to this day, there remain hundreds of thousands of other files. First, and especially there's a work of a journalist named Ian Cobain, as well as some others who have identified massive amounts of documents held in the Ministry of Defense and elsewhere that are not being released and in violation of the Freedom of Information Act.
Okay. One thing I was going to ask you about was, before you mentioned that that violence was endemic throughout the British Empire, but were there any colonies that didn't fit this model? Were there any colonies where the colonized populations were treated in a better way?
I think it's important to remember, and something that I point out in the book, and that is violence was not being deployed at all times in all places, always, right? That there were interstices in which people operated locally. And at the same time, what's very important to underscore is that violence or the threat of violence was always there, right? And so therefore, when I make the point about, you know, all empires being violent, you're imposing your rule on someone else, sort of in layman's terms, right? And how do you do that? Now, typically when we think about the relationship between a citizen in the state, there's something that goes back, way back to sort of ideas of liberalism and folks like Locke and the rest of it, right? Social contract. You give up a certain amount of your rights in return for something else. And this is done more or less voluntarily, but the state always holds the monopoly on the use of violence. In Empire, this is thrown into relief because those who have engaged, if you will, in the social contract have done so involuntarily. There's not a, it's been imposed upon them. And so I think it's important to remember that all empires are violent. The threat of violence is always there. Does it happen every day in every place and every second? No. And the question becomes, what I'm quite interested in is looking at when violence erupts, right? And when violence erupts and when it's state-directed violence. So what I'm not looking at, and not to say it's unimportant, what I'm not examining is, you know, sort of, if you will, and again, I use quotes on here, sort of casual violence deployed in by settlers on plantations or something. I'm interested in when the state is involved. And then thinking about those systems, right, the legal systems and the intersection between the law and violence and colonial lived experiences and how that plays out over time.
So we talked earlier about the civilizing mission and about things like the white man's burden. But another major aspect of British imperialism, I suppose, was Christianity, and there was a lot of missionaries being sent out alongside the soldiers. But didn't that kind of Christian mission conflict with the violence that was being meted out on people, or was there a way to make accommodation with that?
The missionaries play an important role in the story that I'm telling at various points, and I'll raise two of them, one of which is in Palestine during the Arab Revolt in the late 1930s, and the second of which is in Kenya in the 1950s. And in Palestine, and one of the reasons why I'm giving you these two examples is because those are the places in particular where there's a wealth of records remaining, and they're coming from the missionaries themselves, right? So if one just went into the public, right, or into the national archives looking for missionaries in these places, you'd come up with it a little bit here and there. So you're looking at these private archives. And in the case of Palestine, there are deputations coming from high up in the Anglican Church in Palestine, to the governor, to the High Commissioner and the Chief Secretary, detailing the excruciating acts of violence being perpetrated against members of the Arab population. And there are others that are, if you will, somewhat more colorful, describing even Montgomery and his zeal and zest for deploying violence against the Arab population. And what becomes clear from the historical record is that one of the things that the missionaries are wrestling with is the degree that they are there and present in Palestine and elsewhere in the empire at the discretion of the High Commissioner or the governor, right? And so there's only so far that they can push it. And there's one interesting quote in the Palestine case where I believe it was the head of the Anglican Church there, who finally resolves himself to saying, "I'm going to be worried about sort of basically the next worldly lives of these individuals." In other words, you know, grace is going to come in the next life, and I have to have acceptance for this one, which I found quite poignant, actually. And I think the thing that struck me as well in the Palestine instance, and I'll give you a couple of examples from Kenya, is the degree to which members of the church were deeply distressed by what was going on, their relative powerlessness, the degree to which in the late 30s they were not interested in going public in any kind of way. But yet there were others who did. There was a welfare officer in Palestine at the time who was a cause celeb and published many of these accounts, right? Lands on the floor of parliament, becomes a big topic of discussion in the Permanent Mandates Commission for the League of Nations. So all of this is out there. And it gets back in some ways up to your question about readers and listeners, right? That what's so stunning is the degree to which, when you line up all this evidence, how much people, even with the concealment that was going on, how much people knew, right? It's very, very hard to explain this as a bunch of sort of one-offs and bad apples. And then if we move forward to Kenya, similar kinds of experiences that I just described. And at the same time, by the 1950s, there are several within the missionary society who become quite outspoken And there's publications, for instance, Kenya, A Time for Action, and others, which provide not just ample evidence for historians like myself, but also huge amounts of evidence connecting the dots for readers to see the degree to which missionaries were aware of this and were trying to do something about it. And my last point is that there are indications, particularly in the Kenyan case, that there were some missionaries who felt otherwise, who felt as though, you know, the execution and use of violence was part of the civilizing mission. And that too complicates the narrative. So I don't want readers to come away or listeners to come away with sort of a good guy, bad guy kind of dichotomy. And I would just urge those in general, whether it's this book or thinking about empire in general, to try to step away from that. Was it a force of good? Was it a force of evil? You know, was somebody a good guy or bad guy? Oftentimes there's a combination both of these, which makes it both more complicated and also, I think, in some ways more interesting and realistic when we think about just human experiences in general.
Now, a lot of the examples you've talked about took place fairly close to these colonies' independence. For example, what was going on with the Mau Mau in Kenya and in Malaya. So did the British Empire actually become more violent as it reached its conclusion?
Yes, I think what's important, let's step back for a second, because in some ways this book was supposed to be you know, maybe a chapter or so on sort of pre-World War II, and it's supposed to be a book all about post-World War II. The book is at least about a half pre-World War II, right? Long before independence, you know, the first real independence is coming in as you know, in India in 1947. And so what it's doing is it's demonstrating that this isn't sort of episodic or correlative, you know, we can make a correlation with sort of end of empire and a violent demise. That violence was the handmaiden of empire, right? It was the midwife of empire. And it was there throughout the, you know, its entire existence. So if we step back, India would be a great example, right? We think about independence in 1947. You know, the mutiny takes place in 1857. Amritsar in 1919, the level of sort of systematized violence that's being carried out and the ways in which these are explained and reworked into a notion about a civilizing mission. If we look at the Palestinian Mandate, right, which the British take on after World War I, taking it over from the Ottoman Empire, and of course the Mandate, you know, was parsed out from the Ottoman Empire, the Mandate being part of the League of Nations. But the Arab Revolt was from 1936 to 1939, and again, it's another, you know, nearly decade before Palestine is, you know, if you will, seizes independence. It you know, ultimately the British tried to hand it over to the UN, and then the war breaks out there and has been continuing in different ways ever since. And so I think in that sense, it's important for folks to be thinking about this thread that goes through and how extraordinarily violent and the ways in which we can, you know, connect 1954 Kenya to 1944 or so India to, you see what I'm saying, over this long trajectory. And we do so not just as historians because we're kind of lining things up, but we can do so by tracing the movement of people and ideas through the empire. So we have folks who are executing various policies in Palestine in the 1930s or India even earlier, and suddenly they're going to pop up for the reader later on in Kenya in 1954, right? And so it's a combination of ideology, it's a combination of movement of people, a combination of transference of ideas and individuals and tactics. And in that sense, as I mentioned before in our conversation, it reminds us of a kind of spider's web of connectivity. And it's that stepping back that where we can take it in its totality.
What, if anything, do you think the British government could or should do now to recognize or seek to make amends for this violence that was carried out in its name?
It's a question that I think many, many, many people are grappling with today, right? And I'm not going to profess myself to be a politician or a public relations expert. I'm an historian. And in that sense, I think a very close examination of the history curricula is start number one, and revising that in a way that, you know, reflects lived experiences of empire that takes young people away from hagiographies of empire. And in some ways, when you think about the passing on of tradition, if, you know, recently polled, as you pointed out, about 60% of Britons believe empire is something to be proud of. Many of those school teachers, some were, you know, raised on the books of Seeley, were literally fed, you know, if you will, propaganda during war, post-war, of the values of the British Empire while covering up its crimes. They were then taught by, you know, so genealogically, you know, teachers pass on, parents pass on. I was had a very interesting conversation the other day with a friend of mine who I respect greatly, and she's also a writer, and she was saying, you know, she'd read the book and said, you know, I think about my own daughter that I haven't shared with her the fact that many people in our family lived and worked and out in empire, were part of the colonial administration. Why? And she sort of asked rhetorically, why haven't I done that? And I think that's the other thing for listeners to be thinking about. What's your own genealogical past? And it's not to say to sort of bring out the skeletons of the family closet, but rather to have these conversations. And I should emphasize, too, that out in empire, when I was working on my book in Kenya, I was stunned by the degree to which many of those survivors of the camps and emergency villages with whom I spoke and interviewed, their children and grandchildren never knew they'd been detained. They were so ashamed. They just didn't know how to have this conversation. And I think in that sense, learning starts at home, learning starts at school. And then there are bigger debates to be had about statues and the rest. And I think those are important ones. The mayor of London has been having those in particular. And I think in that sense, you know, I go back to my point about, you know, toppling Colton into the River Avon is not erasing history. Burning documents and not offering young people and old, you know, and those sort of, consider myself old-ish, or those who are of the older generation, facts and evidence for them to be rethinking their own nation's past.
That was Caroline Elkins. Legacy of Violence, A History of the British Empire is out now, published by Bodley Head. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.